from the book The Open Door of Emptiness by James Lowe. Chapter 4 Wisdom and Compassion, Part 2 Consciousness. Mental consciousness is the means by which we construct patterns of identification and develop assumptions, intentions, and plans. This kind of mental clarity allows us to have an intention as to how we're going to proceed. However, our mental consciousness can be a very sophisticated liar. We all have a little public relations department inside us, so that when things go badly, our little spin doctor steps forward. Oh well, it wasn't too bad really, because at the end of the day, the show must go on. We've got to hang in there. But this involves a lot of editing, a lot of adjusting. This is the nature of consciousness. It's a very busy phenomenon. It's the organization of our mental structure, of all the different thoughts, feelings, and sensations that need to be sorted out into patterns and evaluated as helpful or unhelpful, and so on. This is continuous work going on all the time. It's not surprising that we get very tired. Some unexpected new event comes along. I've had it up to here. I just don't need any more. We are a sort of middle management. We're not the big boss. We're not the CEO. We're trying to get the people underneath us to do things, but every time we delegate, the buggers do the wrong thing. You delegate a task to your memory, but as you get older, your memory lets you down and you forget. It all gets a little bit scary. It's all up to me. It's the paranoid position of an individualized sense of self-identity. When in fact, our consciousness is constituted by a stream of thoughts, feelings, and sensations. Some of these thoughts may seem directly relevant. They feel not only like me, but helpful to me. Others can feel like me because they are familiar, but they're not very helpful. And some other thoughts are just plain weird. All kinds of strange stuff comes to us in sleeping dreams, in daydreams, in sudden thoughts that shoot across our mind. It's all too much to make sense of. That is why traditional Buddhist texts say there is no end to samsara. The field of experience is too complicated, too complex to sort out. It keeps changing. Consciousness, which has the function of organizing our participation, is essentially a dynamic, interactive movement. It is the function of engagement, but it's not a stable identity. So the question, how can I know who I am, is actually a false question, since you cannot know who you are. You can be yourself. You can be yourself as an emergent subjectivity, but you're never actually a thing, an object that can be known. Interacting with circumstances, we are present as ourselves, however that might be. Being and knowing. Being and knowing are not the same, and especially knowing about things is not the same as the kind of pure knowing. For example, you go out and you see some snowdrops, and they're very sweet. But then you see a robin. Oh, a double whammy. Snowdrops and a robin. Oh, the heart melts. It's very nice. You're looking at this gorgeous little event. In a sense, you know it. And so there's nothing to think about. You just look at the snowdrops. It's a sort of wonder and awe. It's the knowing, but not knowing about. That causes the little door to open, and we have a sense of being fresh. We're replenished. We return to ourselves through these simple moments of beauty. Blackbirds singing in the evening. It's evocative, maybe of memories of childhood or other happy times. But it's also evocative of a deeper and lighter sense of ourselves. We are evoked into, oh, oh. That's the arena of meditation. To move from knowing about things towards trusting the direct meaning given to us in the spontaneous revelation of the world when we open to it. It's much easier for most of us to open to a snowdrop than to open to the sound of a tire screeching. We retract from that. We don't want that in our field, even though it's just a transient event, like the perception of the snowdrop. When we say that this is good and I want more of it, and this is bad and I want less of it, or I don't want it near me, we can see that the openness of awareness is easily closed down by the particularization of egoic judgment. How the emergent event is, in its simplicity, is being distorted by my self-referential interpretations of it. Our habit of trying to get the good things and trying to avoid the bad things is considered again and again in Buddhist texts. In my book, Simply Being, there are many encouragements to meditators not to try to push away bad thoughts and hang on to good thoughts. It is as if bad thoughts are like squatters breaking into our house. We know they're going to spoil how we want it to be. However, by opting to prolong good thoughts, we're back with gardening, flowers and weeds. Get rid of the weeds. Feed the flowers. Busy, busy, always busy, because seeds are blowing in the wind into your garden. Even when you're asleep, some little weed is starting to dig itself in. When we meditate, we encounter all these thoughts sprouting. Meditation involves two aspects. One is to relax into the open spaciousness of awareness itself, and the other is to become aware of the incredible pull of our habit of identifying with thoughts. These thoughts seem meaningful to us. In the field of psychotherapy, it is very common to encounter people who have become reliant on negative views about themselves. They are convinced that they have something wrong with their physical form, or that they are unlovable, or that their life is meaningless, and the best thing they can do is kill themselves. If your own life is not too bad, you may wonder why somebody would hang on to a belief like that. They come to therapy for a couple of months, and you hope and expect that they will get some progress now that you have given them a description of their patterns. Another 2 months go by. The description of the problem still seems valid. However, nothing much is changing. Why do they hang on to a belief which is so awful, that restricts them and keeps them in a frightened, inhibited place? That is because being frightened and inhibited feels like home. That is the domain which that person's particular structure has adapted to. And therefore, its familiarity has become more powerful than the bitter taste of its content. This is just how I am. Why would the negative, the destructive, the awful become home? Because anything can be home. Human beings can identify with anything, no matter how seemingly awful. We can see a softer version of the same structure in our meditation practice. We want to relax into open awareness, but we fall into thoughts again and again. Because thoughts seem so useful, we merge with the thoughts. The thought seems incredibly important, so we merge with the thought. It seems meaningful to go off in a daydream about something. You're sitting, you want to focus your mind, relax and be open, but you're gone. Why? Well, it seemed like a good idea at the time. Maybe we could all have these words carved on our gravestone. It is important to see this, because there can be a danger that we use meditation to beat ourselves up if we feel we're not making much progress, or that we think it's not working and we give up on it. The attachment that has us merging with our thoughts is the root structure of samsara. This is why we're here, because of the nature of attachment. Attachment, in this sense, is not a conscious kind of attachment, like me as the subject, being attached to something as the object. This more problematic kind of attachment is the immediate merging of our consciousness with what is arising for it. Consciousness only emerges as a formation in relation to an object. The actuality of our world is non-dual. There is no wall between subject and object, between mind and the content of the mind. We can't set up a border post with a barrier that announces, "Hey, you can't come in here." Or, "You, you're very welcome." There are no customs officers checking what thoughts can come in and what can't. Thoughts, feelings, and sensations are immediately here, so we can't prepare in advance to control them. They occur before we know what is happening. If you feel persecuted by your thoughts and fight to control them, then meditation is going to be very difficult for you. We need to relax out of our assumptions and attend to thoughts as they are. Only by this does it become obvious that they have no inherent existence. The reifying ego self cannot outwit the thoughts that it itself reifies. If you self-identify as a drinker, then struggling not to drink is very hard. Why? Because you're a drinker. And until that core definition of being a drinker stops, then if there's a bottle, you're going to open it. However, if you stop being a drinker, you can look at the bottle and think, "I'm not fussed. Someone else can have it." Some space has opened up. Nothing has happened to the bottle. The object hasn't changed. It's just the same. But the hook between the object and the drinker has dropped. It's the same for smokers. If you're a smoker, the packet calls to you. If you're not a smoker, the packet doesn't say anything at all. In fact, it says what it says on the label. This will kill you. But if you're a smoker, it doesn't say that. It says, oh, this will be nice. That's how it happens. That's what we have to see. It's exactly the same structure with thoughts, feelings, and sensations. As long as our primary self-definition is rooted in an individualized, particularizing consciousness, that consciousness will merge with thoughts, feelings, and sensations. And we will always be caught up in this interaction. Therefore, the heart of the practice is to relax out of consciousness into awareness. Distinguishing between awareness and consciousness. Awareness and consciousness are not the same. Awareness has no form or shape. It doesn't come from anywhere and it doesn't go anywhere. It is uncatchable. That's why you cannot know awareness. It's not an object for the mind. But you can be aware. You can relax into a state of awareness within which consciousness will be moving around. Consciousness, as the individual personal subject, and the experiences of consciousness as your perceptions of the world, these will be moving together, and you can see them to be the energy of your experience, but not as the ground of your experience. The ground of your experience is the inseparability of awareness and space. This is to say that awareness is uncatchable, ungraspable. It's not a thing, yet it's always present. That's why it can be filled with whatever is occurring, and that whatever is occurring is devoid of self-existence. Consciousness, on the other hand, is always taking on particular shapes in particular moments. Suddenly you feel thirsty. Suddenly you want to go for a walk. Suddenly you remember, oh, tomorrow it's Monday, and on Monday I have to go to the dentist. A moment before, you might have been relaxing. Then suddenly the thought comes, oh, did I turn off the gas? The body tenses. You start to get a bit preoccupied. That's consciousness at work. A thought gives consciousness a poke, and consciousness runs after the thought. It's an interplay of energy. It's like a pas de deux. Two dancers are moving together. They're no longer two separate dancers, because the choreography has linked the movement of their bodies as a communication. The consciousness that says, I remember what I have to do on Monday, is two things. It's an object in the sense of being a flow of thought patterns arising in the mind, and it's also the subject in being aware that this is what you have to do on Monday. Whatever is happening, whether seemingly subject or object, is simply a transient patterning of the ungraspable energy of the mind. It is this which is misconstrued as being our existence in a world of existence. Experience has no experiencer. Experience is the unborn clarity of awareness itself. In the traditional example, awareness is said to be like a mirror. A mirror shows what is there. What is there, in terms of our existence, is the ceaseless movement of thinker and thought, feeler and feeling, sensor and sensation. Sometimes awareness shows what looks like a subject, sometimes what looks like an object. They chase each other like a kitten chasing its tail. This tumbling is the energy of our experience and is the way in which, as patterns of energy, we participate in the world with others. When it works well, this pulsation of energy is very stimulating. It is the external form of our internal active and passive movement, of being the thinker and the thought. This energetic formation of dance and dancers needs a stage. The stage, both the external stage and the internal stage, is awareness. Awareness, because it has no form or colour or content, is the field in which all our experience is arising. It's hidden from us, not because it's secret or high or holy or special, not because we are unworthy or damaged or obscured, but just because we are caught up in all this falsely reified stuff. We are so busy looking at interactions and being part of interactions that we don't see the field within which it's happening. We take the space for granted. We take being alive for granted. What does it mean to be alive? What is this freshness of existence? The fact that experience is revealing itself moment by moment by moment. In the Dzogchen teachings, we talk of three modes, or three linked fields. There is the open field, which is awareness itself, which is empty and unborn. This means that it has no substance to it. It's inconceivable. You can't really describe it. Within this, instantly, is the spontaneous revelation of the entire field of experience. Each of us, sitting here, has a unique world being revealed to us, our particular take. Whatever seat you've chosen to sit on gives you, through your sense organs, a particular revelation of this room. Nobody else will have the same, neither perceptually nor interpretively. Each of us is the centre of the world in this specific way. There are similarities, but these are similarities established through language and concepts. The openness is this field, bright, vibrant, and changing. Within this luminosity is the third field, which is our gestural presence, in which we speak, we listen, we move, we stretch, we hear, we have thoughts and feelings. It is a responsive field. The open field of awareness is unchanging. The richness of the field of spontaneous display, called Lundrup in Tibetan, is immediate, always changing. Within it, we have the particularity of our fresh emergence, moment by moment. Each emergent patterning is specific, responsive, and ungraspable. Yet, because we're not in touch with this open arena, which is our ground, we don't see the light, playful, illusory nature of what is displaying itself. forgetfulness of the open ground and its radiance and its responsiveness gives rise to our busy thinking, by which we have to make sense of what is going on. This busyness is the preoccupation by which we avoid seeing the ground of our existence. It's as straightforward as that. Teachings given in Macclesfield, UK, 22nd to 24th of February, 2013. Edited by Barbara Tarras and revised by James Lowe in March 2023. From the book The Open Door of Emptiness, a collection of public talks and teachings by James Lowe. Read by Wendy, July 2026.